Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Welcome to This Miraculous Life on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Sarah Oliveri Olumba. I started this podcast because I have a core belief that life is mind-blowingly phenomenal and miraculous and just an insanely precious gift. And the goal of this podcast is for us to be able to tune in with that on a day-to-day basis and tune out the day-to-day bullshit that gets in the way of that. I have my master's degree in positive psychology, which is essentially just the scientific study of human thriving. And for the past 2 years, I have been voted the best life coach in Washington, D.C. So each episode, we are hearing from a listener who has a question about their own life and something that's happening in their life that is either getting in the way of them tuning in with the miraculousness of life or just challenging them, or even perhaps a good thing that they want to know how to have on a day-to-day basis or how to build upon. So today we are hearing from a writer who calls him or herself comfortably miserable, a sentiment I feel like we can all relate to at one time or another in our life. So, Jack, are you ready to hear from Comfortably Miserable?
I'm very ready, and I relate. already I relate.
I know, right? Me too.
Well, maybe I aspire to be comfortably miserable.
Right. At least the miserable part is relatable. Mm-hmm. So here we go. This is what Comfortably Miserable has to say to us. Dear Sarah, for the past 3 years, I have been working at a small financial consultancy. I work in sales and marketing operations. I'm good at what I do. I know what makes a good customer and how to make a sale. I know how to direct our marketing department to create campaigns to build our brand and business. I know how to balance team realities with the boss's demands. The boss is happy with me, and I am liked by my colleagues. But I hate this job.
I can relate to that a little bit. And I, not my current job. And I have hated it for at least 2 out of the 3 years that I have been employed here. I hate it so much that I fake sick, and most people stopped doing that in junior high. It's not just that I don't find purpose in my tasks. I'm not sure I even like this industry. I feel like I am good at what I do by mistake. I don't give a shit about finance and investment. Despite my lack of interest, I have performed well and been rewarded for it. Since being employed here, I have received 2 promotions and accompanying pay raises. I am the boss's rock. He relies on me to fix problems with customers, manage my team, and keep things humming along. If he asks me to take on an additional project that requires me to stay late, I do it. I want to say, sorry, but I don't have the capacity for this right now, and go home. But I don't. I don't resent him for it. I resent myself. I am too comfortable executing on someone else's instructions and not comfortable enough executing on my own plans and interests. Plus, in the back of my mind, I know that even if I were to put my foot down and clock out or log off, I have nothing much to look forward to outside of work anyway. How can I start saying no to my boss and yes to myself? Yes to my free time away from work. Even though I am now in a more senior role at the company and have experienced salary growth, this has not made me any more satisfied at work or outside of work. For the most part, I work so much that I'm not making use of a slightly more comfortable financial position. And at work, I feel like I'm just towing the line and repeating a daily cycle. I've seen many people come and go through the doors of our consultancy, including some good friends of mine.
When I see them go, I'm jealous and painfully aware of how miserable I am. After the most recent farewell party for a colleague and friend, I was so upset that I faked the flu and called in sick for a whole week. I was not sick, just too low to work. I guess it was a combination of grief and envy for having sent off another friend who has managed to move on to better things while I stay in the same place. Several friends who have new positions have offered me interviews with their teams, saying, with my experience and track record, I have a great shot of landing a more interesting role, but I always turn them down. They know I'm not happy with my job and are baffled why I don't try something new. I really can't explain. I guess I'm risk averse. I am too worried about screwing everything up if I try, but I know that's not really a good reason. Why did I say no? Why can't I manage to take a chance on an opportunity that I so badly need? Basically, I am comfortably miserable. How can I get out of this cycle? How can I take a risk on something new when it will jeopardize all of the stability that I rely on? Hope you can save me from myself. Sincerely, comfortably miserable. Wow, comfortably miserable. I hear the misery. Do you hear the misery, Jack?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, okay, so there's a number of things that I want to address in your letter, comfortably miserable. The first is, hopefully you were listening last week and heard about this idea of understanding your core values so that you can use that exercise to gain some direction, you know? Because it sounds like, so let's dive in right there. So comfortably miserable, part of what I'm hearing in your letter, this is the first big thing, is that you're calling yourself comfortably miserable, but to the point that Jack made kind of in the beginning, like maybe I can relate to the miserable part, but perhaps I aspire to the comfortable part. To be honest, comfortably miserable, you don't sound that comfortable yourself. Maybe, you know, you're right, like the current circumstances, it's known, it's familiar, but I would say comfortable is a strong word to describe the familiar misery that you're experiencing. But what I do hear you talk about is being baffled that you've stayed this long, having received opportunities, requests to even go and take advantage of something else to get out of there, and you're turning it down. So my read into this is that it's not just that you are comfortable, quote unquote, where you are. That makes sense that that's part of it, that is your sort of where you don't have the fear, right? But the other part that I'm hearing is that you lack direction for where to go if you were to make a change, right? Which to me is a little bit of a different thing. It's like maybe you would be ready to leave and jump for something new if you had an idea about what that new thing might be that you would be excited about and into. So I almost want to relieve some of the pressure from you comfortably miserable, because you say, you talk about friends of yours who are offering you opportunities. You say, I always turn them down. But you know, with your track record, you have a great shot of landing a quote unquote more interesting role. So my take on that is, if you have people offering you these other roles that they're saying, hey, you're really well qualified with this role, with your experience, you could definitely most likely get the role. My take is, you said earlier in the letter, you have no interest. I do not give a shit about finance and investment. So putting those two things together, perhaps you are being offered roles that are in line with your current experience, which is an experience that you hate and do not find interesting or engaging or meaningful to you at all. And so I kind of want to like give you some credit here and say, okay, don't beat yourself up too much for not having jumped for something new yet, because it sounds like perhaps the new opportunities that you're being presented with or that you're seeing readily, you're afraid that they might be too similar to what you're already doing, right? They might not be enough of a change. And to me, that's actually a pretty legitimate reason not to change a situation, even if that situation is already shitty. Jack is the founder of Full Service Radio, and he's actually here in the recording studio with me today. So I'm checking in with him from time to time to see if he's picking up what I'm putting down.
Mm-hmm. Very yeah. much so. This kind of reminds me of the advice you get, or that one would get sometimes when they're single for a while. And it's like, well, the harder you look, maybe the less of a chance you have at finding something.
Amen.
You know?
Yeah.
I know in my life, I've been in a situation like this professionally, and I would apply to all kinds of crazy jobs just with the hope of escaping what right. I was in. And those jobs, I was, in retrospect, I'm like, oh my God, imagine if I right. took that job.
Right.
Being crazy.
Right, exactly.
But, it's a tough one, because if you're miserable, it's definitely not good for your mental health, right?
Totally.
To stay there.
Totally. Yeah, I think that's an awesome point. I love the connection, Jack, actually, that you made between this and being single. I think that that's actually a great connection, because people put loads of pressure. I hope somebody sends me a letter about this. I think people put loads of pressure to like go out and find a partner, which to me seems like actually a pretty bad idea, to go like hunting for just a thing, right? Like hunting for partnership rather than simply understanding like, what am I looking for?
Yeah.
And then especially with something like partnership, understanding what do I really want? And then seeing what comes to you is the way that I would put it as it relates with romantic partnership. The job thing is certainly a little bit more malleable. It's a little more, in my opinion, something that we can like drive forward to create and pursue, given that it's more of an individual creation rather than something where definitely we're relying on somebody else to bring 50% of the equation. But I love the idea, Jack, that I think is implicit in what you said, that it's really not about just like making a change or like getting a thing. It's about getting a thing that you actually want and will enjoy. And so with the job thing, comfortably miserable, my idea is this, that you can be a little bit nicer to yourself for not having left yet, because I think that's a situation that a lot of people find themselves in. And I also think that let's go out on a limb here. Maybe you're actually a little bit more advanced because you're not putting yourself out there for a bunch of crap that you think, well, this will be different, but it would still be crap, right? So my number one suggestion, comfortably miserable, would be to find out what you would find more interesting than what you're currently doing. And here's the thing, there's no way to know for sure until you try it. So I think two things here. One is to do that exercise that was talked about in last week's episode. And last week's episode was written in by a person who thought they were experiencing a quarter life crisis. So you guys can look for that one. And basically what I walk you through is a process of understanding what I call your quote unquote current operating system. And your current operating system is all of the values that influence the way that you're living your life now, whether to your benefit or your detriment. And then the second phase of that exercise is looking at all the values that you've collected from your conscious and your subconscious mind and teasing apart which ones are to your benefit and which ones are actually to your detriment. And then from there, honing in, whittling down on what I call your core values, which are usually 4 to 6 words that represent your personal most important operating principles. Like, these words represent what you want your life to be all about. And then on the other hand, honing in on what I call your demons, which are the values that are a part of how you are operating now, a part of the decisions that you're making, a part of the way that you're thinking about yourself, thinking about your life. But those are the ones that actually, when we look at them closely, we think, my life would be happier or more fulfilling if I could withdraw some of my stock from those values. So number one, comfortably miserable, I want you to start thinking about what your core values are and thinking about how those values are being satisfied or lacking in your life currently. And then I want you to think about how your current job either contributes to or clashes with your core values. And our job doesn't necessarily have to be a strong contributor to our values because, you know, that's not always an option. But what it can't do is clash with our core values. So our job cannot be about something that we think is like fundamentally wrong or a fundamental waste of time, right? So I want you to check for that comfortably miserable. And I want you to start thinking about, you know, what careers, if any, would be something that would actually contribute to these values that I hold. And then on the other hand, I want you to also check in with your demons and find out what those demons are. And I'm going to be honest here. So you speak at the end of your letter about the fear of losing all of the stability that you have and all that you've built. And here's the deal. For better or for worse, when I do this exercise with people, the exercise of understanding your operating system, your core values, and your demons, when I do this exercise with myself, what I find is that 9 times out of 10, a word like stability or security shows up not as a core value, but rather as a demon. Why might that be? Why might that be? So Jack is listening. I see him nodding his head. I know he's taken a few risks to his stability in life. So I wonder, why are you nodding your head over there, Jack?
Well, I mean, it's exactly that. I mean, stability is a fear to me, because it's for me personally, then I'm not acting out of passion or,
right.
You know, it's not fulfilling me in all the other places. Just because something is stable doesn't really mean it's going to make my life better.
Amen.
I kind of apply that to all aspects of my life, or I try to.
Right.
So, yeah, right. That can be tricky with work. But there are real realities that people face as well, including me. So it's fine.
True. Line. Yeah, that's true. That's an important thing to acknowledge that I might have skipped over. So thanks for bringing that in, Jack. But I like the point that Jack made, and the way that I would put it is that stability does not necessarily go hand in hand with passion. Stability, security, and passion may be mutually exclusive. And I would say, in general, that is a true fact, at least in the beginning of starting something, of beginning something new. And so, comfortably miserable, here is what I would encourage. I would encourage you to truly examine the role of stability in your life and all of these elements that you are valuing in your current job that you consider to be contributing to stability. And I want you to really think about how much putting your stock in stability is serving you. And to Jack's point, there are real realities. So what I often do myself and what I encourage other people to do is really drill down and figure out what really is the reality. Like, really, really. Okay, so I think often we build up our need for stability so high that it becomes something that we start to believe I literally cannot survive unless I make unless I make over 50K a year, unless I have a health insurance plan that does not have a high premium, unless I have my own apartment that I don't have to share with anybody else, unless I live within 5 minutes walking distance from work, unless I can, you know, fly to visit this person at least 4 times a year, unless I can keep gas in my Range Rover, unless I can, you know, like all of these things start to feel like necessities. And what I really encourage people to do is to figure out legitimately what are your actual bare necessities, like your bare cost of living. Okay, like what could you survive on? And start to see that as the necessity for stability rather than all of these other things. So it's like if the floor falls out from underneath you, how long could you survive if you, like, you know, picked up an odd job or didn't have any income for a certain number of months, right? But I think that my observation is that we highly overestimate the amount of stuff and of financial resources that we need to survive. And to me, that is one of the first places to start dismantling this security, this stability demon, and liberate ourselves from the sort of handcuffs of staying at a job that we hate, basically. So that's number one. I want you comfortably miserable, and everybody else listening who's trying to figure out what's my next move. It's not that you have to lose everything, right? But I think that pursuing something that we really care about and are really fired up about often requires us to take a risk. Okay. And so knowing literally how much risk we can get away with, like worst case scenario, what can we survive upon? I think that that's important to know, because otherwise my observation is that we kind of delude ourselves and we're doing all these things to maintain a level of security, a level of stability, and a lifestyle that A, we do not need, and B, that is already making us miserable. So it's like, what is the purpose of having a nice apartment and a car and, you know, never taking public transportation, whatever, whatever, eating out even, you know, like there are so many ways to make our lifestyle more affordable, especially in the short term, to get a roommate, you know, all of these things. If we already know that we're currently miserable, I personally think we should really be willing to examine what is the bare minimum. And in taking a risk, how can I just simply make sure that I stay above that bare minimum before I begin to panic, right? And what I see is that people begin to panic like months and like thousands of dollars before they really need to. And that, to me, is like I said, handcuffs. That is the opposite of liberating yourself. So I want to talk a little bit more about this idea of risk taking and comfortably miserable. Here's what I want you to know. Everything that is observable, everything that I see that truly brings deep satisfaction and meaning to people's lives requires taking a risk, requires risking your stability. Everything from starting a business to saying I love you to someone, all of those things require us to risk our stability, risk our security, risk that it might not work out. And so my opinion is that in order to find our most fulfilling life, we want to find what we're willing to risk that it might not work out for. But here's the thing. We also have to understand that trying some things out is part of the equation. You know, even the people who take the greatest risks, they didn't know when they started their business or when they got into their sport, you know, or when they changed career paths, you know, in midlife. They didn't know 100% I'm going to love this, right? Because you literally cannot know that until you try it. And so if the worst thing that you do in life is try something because you want to feel more deeply engaged, you want to feel more meaning in your life, and then it ends up that you don't like it, to me, that is a success. It is a success to live your life awake enough and brave enough to try things, to look for meaning, to look for engagement, to look for fulfillment, to seize the driver's wheel in your life rather than just riding along on the pre-prescribed bus that people have offered to pick you up in. Okay. So I want to mention a concept that I believe can help all of us to tap into our risk-taking ability, even if it does not come natural to us. And the concept that I want to introduce and teach all of you today is called optimism. And something that I learned recently, I was giving a presentation at a startup, and any startup is a risk, right? Like, that's why it's called that, because it has not gotten to the point yet in its development that it is no longer at risk, okay? And so I was talking to the people at this startup about how to be resilient and how to tap into optimism in the face of failures or setbacks or, you know, punches in the face. And one of the things that I learned in preparing for this presentation is that a very famous psychologist named Daniel Kahneman, he's done a lot of research on behavioral economics and the way that human beings make choices, which is not always logical, but is often adaptive for us. And one of his findings is that there is a common trait that entrepreneurs rate highly in. And that common trait is delusional optimism. And so delusional optimism means exactly what it sounds like. It means believing against the odds in the possibility of their individual success, right? And so at first blush, delusional optimism might sound like a bad thing. We might be like, why delusional optimism? Whoa, that seems like something to definitely avoid in my life. But here's the thing. Delusional optimism is an essential ingredient for a thriving world, okay? Without delusional optimism, there is literally no progress. In order to try something new, in order to try something that you don't know what the outcome is going to be for sure, there has to be delusional optimism. So we actually owe our world and our opportunities to have jobs to the delusional optimists. So I would say being able to tap into delusional optimism is essentially like a magic potion. Like, if we can tap into delusional optimism, then we present ourselves with the possibility to create and to access opportunities in our life that other people believe that they simply do not have the possibility for, right? Is this making sense to you, Jack?
Yeah. To me, it feels just like power of intention. Just like, right, saying it out loud, as crazy as it sounds, like, no, this is going to happen. Like, absolutely. I'm going to move to London, even if that seems crazy.
Right.
But that, if that's what you want, just keep saying it out loud.
Right.
And then it will happen. I believe strongly in that.
Right. Right. That, yeah, that's a good point. And I like this idea about the power of intention, Jack, because the other thing about delusional optimists and optimists in general is that people think they have to save us from ourselves, or I have to save this person from themselves. You know, if you're thinking delusionally, isn't that a thought that needs to be corrected and fixed? and like drilled out of somebody so that they don't make a horrific mistake? And the answer is not so fast. And the reason why is because if somebody is thinking in a delusionally optimistic way, guess what? They are extremely optimistic. And so they think, oh, you know, this restaurant that I'm opening is going to succeed in spite of the fact that 70% of the restaurants on the block has already failed. But my restaurant will succeed because I have something different and I am going to do this and I am passionate about this, et cetera, et cetera. And so they go, they open their restaurant, and guess what? Maybe their restaurant does fail. But then what happens to them, right? When their restaurant fails, as a delusional optimist, as an extreme optimist, they don't say to themselves, this ruins everything. My life is over. It's all my fault. I should have known. No, they say, okay, I'm going to close up shop here. I'm going to take all of the resources that I bought to open this restaurant, and I'm going to go to this other block where business seems to be popping more. And I'm going to start again there. And I'm going to take what I learned from that first experience and apply it to my second experience. And maybe their second restaurant fails. And then they take what they learned from that experience and apply it to their third experience, et cetera, et cetera. And so the reality of the situation is that a delusional optimist doesn't need to be saved from themselves, because when they fail, which they might, right, they don't experience it as devastating. They're able to continue on. They're able to bounce back. They don't fall into a deep, dark hole of my whole life is ruined because of this setback. That is a part of what being an optimist means. So the two go hand in hand. So I want to teach you guys today how to introduce this skill of optimistic thinking into your own individual lives. This is one of the most valuable things that I learned in my experience studying positive psychology, and that I've translated into a skill set to actually prompt our brain to be able to access the valuable tool and sort of like boost of being able to think optimistically. So in the psychological sense, here's what optimism means. Optimism specifically means, to psychologists, thinking about good things and bad things according to three specific parameters. And those parameters are the three P's. And the three P's are permanence, pervasiveness, and personalization. And so what the research says is that when an optimist is faced with a bad thing or a setback or a failure, however you want to put it, they interpret that thing as not permanent. Okay, so in other words, a setback, let's stick with this example I'm using. The optimist's restaurant starts to operate at a deficit, right? They're starting to go under. The optimist says to themselves, well, this situation is not going to be permanent. My restaurant is not going to be failing forever, right? Or I'm not going to be in the position of operating a failing restaurant forever. They don't see it as this is something that is the permanent status quo. Nothing can be done to change it or to recover how I feel from it. Okay, so bad things, not permanent. Secondly, the optimist does not view bad things as pervasive. So if something bad happens in the life of the optimist, they don't allow it to contaminate every aspect of their life. So again, with the person who is operating a business that is not thriving, I've been in this position myself, right? You know, I can't say my business was ever necessarily going under, but certainly for the first 2-3 years, it was bringing in an amount of money that most people would consider to be unlivable. but I wasn't saying to myself like, oh, my whole life is going badly because, you know, I'm not making a lot of money. My business isn't taking off, right? I was saying to myself, okay, that's stressful. And it was the first time in my life that I ever felt like I was experiencing symptoms of anxiety. And yet I still felt like things are going good in my life,
right? Like, I'm doing something that I like to do. I'm living in a city that I enjoy. I have an amazing romantic partner. I like the people that I'm around, okay? So it's like I'm deeply stressed in one area, and yet I still can see my blessings, right? I still can see all of the things that I have to be grateful for. I don't feel like because this one thing is going badly, or I experience a setback or got a rejection, that doesn't mean that my life is going badly. There's this Instagram meme or quote that I like, and it says, don't let a bad day let you think that you have a bad life. Don't let a bad day make you believe that you have a bad life. And so I think that is a good summary of what it means to not see bad things as pervasive. Okay. One bad thing doesn't mean everything is bad. And the optimist is able to not only see that, but also believe it and feel it. And then thirdly, when something goes badly, when there's a setback in the life of the optimist, they don't take it personally. They don't say to themselves, oh man, this thing failed because I am so bad, or because nothing ever works for me, or because I did everything wrong. They are able to take responsibility for their contribution to the setback or the bad thing. You know, like if, let's say I got rejected to give a talk, you know, maybe I could take responsibility for having written a proposal in the way that wasn't, that didn't resonate, or that was too complex, right, for the potential client, and be like, okay, next time I'm going to write a proposal that is more resonant and that like states the objectives more simply. Okay. But then I would also say to myself, but you know, maybe this happened because they just didn't have the budget to hire me, or maybe they just got so busy with some other project that they're working on that they no longer have time to bring me in and give a talk about optimism, right? Or you know, whatever the case may be, maybe they realize that they need to bring in somebody else to do something about physical health because they have an urgent problem on their hands. Okay. And so I would not say like, it's because they hated me. Right. And this is all about me and how I caused a bad thing to happen in my own life. And therefore, if I am myself moving forward, I'm likely to experience more bad things. So this is what it means to be an optimist. When something bad happens, to view it as not going to be permanent, not pervasive, seeping into every realm of your life, and not personal. You don't blame it all on yourself. Jack, are you picking up this optimism formula? Is this what you would have thought optimism is?
You're preaching my language right here. This is exactly how I try to live my life. So
I love hearing that.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
I love hearing that. So I want you guys to be able to tap into optimism, and the great news, and really the reason why the field of positive psychology was even founded, is because we began to learn that optimism does not have to be limited to the people who, the subpopulation that thinks that way automatically. Optimism is learnable. My professor, Dr. Martin Seligman, was the person who discovered not just optimism, but learned helplessness. Jack, do you know this term, learned helplessness?
No.
So learned helplessness means that when a person or an animal is faced with a painful or negative and unchangeable situation over and over again, eventually they internalize it and learn that they are helpless to affect positive change in their own life. So for example, one of the studies, they would bring people into a room and then they would play an annoying high-pitched noise and tell the people, okay, use this control panel to turn off the noise. But what they didn't know, what the people in the study didn't know, is that none of the buttons on the control panel could turn off the annoying noise. And so it would bring people into this room over and over again, introducing them to this situation in which the noise is playing. It's very annoying. They're trying to turn it off, but unbeknownst to them, turning it off is not an option. But then after being introduced to that situation enough times, eventually they would introduce them to a different situation in which any
combination of buttons that they pressed on the control panel could turn off the annoying noise. But as a result of the phenomenon of learned helplessness, what had happened is that the people who had been exposed to the situation in which they could not turn off the annoying noise went into the room, listened to the annoying noise, and did what? Nothing. They just sat there. They just listened to the annoying noise until the researcher came to rescue them from it. And so this is the meaning of learned helplessness, that when something bad happens, you know, on multiple occasions, and when we look at the environment, we determine, oh, there's nothing that I could have done to change or prevent this, then we stop trying to make changes in our life. And so Dr. Seligman discovered this phenomenon and went around the world teaching about it. But as he was teaching about it, people in the audience began to notice outliers in his data and say, what about these dots that are not part of the line of best fit in your learned helplessness data? What are they? Why are they not mapping onto the data? What's going on with them? And of course, this is not generally a thing that researchers study. Researchers are looking for what's happening with the average person, what's happening as the general trend. But eventually, Dr. Seligman gave in and was like, okay, you know, maybe we should see what's going on with these outliers. And when he did, he discovered something incredible, which is that the thing that the outliers in his learned helplessness data had in common is that they were all optimists. They were all exceptionally optimistic in interpreting the bad things that were happening to them. In other words, they were all interpreting the setbacks that happened in their life or the painful bad experiences as impermanent, not pervasive, and impersonal. Okay. So what this means is that optimism is effectively an antidote to learned helplessness. And this is a very powerful finding and speaks to what I said earlier about the delusional optimist and why people think, I need to save you. But what the real truth is, no. Don't save that delusional optimist, because guess what? When they fail, they gonna be all right. You know? They're gonna be able to recover from that. It's not going to crush them. And the reason why is because of the optimistic thinking. And so wouldn't it be nice if we all had this antidote to learned helplessness? And so, of course, the next logical question is, if we know what is making these people sort of immune to learned helplessness, and it's this optimistic way of thinking, then the question is, can we teach that way of thinking to other people? And when we do, does it have a similar effect? And the answer is yes. And so this is what I want all of us to come away with today, is that thinking optimistically is a tool that we can introduce into our lives. And it doesn't have to mean what we traditionally think it does. Optimism doesn't have to mean being happy all the time. Optimism doesn't even have to mean being positive all the time. Optimism specifically means interpreting bad things or setbacks as not going to be permanent, not going to be pervasive, and not personal. And there is also a good side to optimism of how the optimist interprets good events, but we can get into that in a later episode. So some questions that I'll leave you with that I have learned helped us to prompt the brain to tap into this optimistic way of thinking are, when something goes wrong in our lives, we can ask ourselves, what factors were outside of my control? And so this allows us to see the elements of the setback that were not personal and for which we cannot blame ourselves. And counter to the way that we may think about it, being able to identify those external factors actually empowers us and allows us to feel more optimistic, but more hopeful about moving forward than if we were to say, oh, it happened because of all of these wrong things that I personally did. Okay, so you can own the things that you did, but it is essential to also be able to identify the factors that were outside your control. So ask yourself, what factors were outside my control? And then you can ask yourself, why won't this be permanent? Okay, and it doesn't have to be the actual event. Like if we lose somebody we love, right? Or if we have to shut down a business. Those things, yes, the situation may be objectively permanent, but permanence can also refer to the feeling that we have in this moment, directly following the pain or the setback. And so the optimist knows, I won't feel this low forever, right? So ask yourself, why won't this be permanent? Either the situation or just the feeling, right? And then in order to think about how that can happen, you can ask yourself, what could I do to change the situation or to move forward from it? So again, integrating that possibility that sometimes we can't change what's already happening. Sometimes the option is to move forward, right? But one of those things is always, always an option. So how can I change the situation or move forward from it? And then to tap into that idea of not letting bad things pervade, ask yourself, in spite of this challenge or in spite of this setback, how have you continued to thrive in other areas of your life? Or if you can't, sometimes if we don't feel like we're thriving, that one's a little hard to access. So you can even ask yourself, in spite of this, what is not going wrong in your life? What is not going badly in your life? Okay, so looking to yourself to identify, in spite of this thing that legit is going wrong or was a setback, how have you continued to thrive or what is not going wrong? So thank you all for listening in today as we hear from Comfortably Miserable, who's trying to figure out how to get out of this rut of being miserable and yet not knowing how or wanting to make a change. And the three main things that we talked about today that I want all of you to come away with is, number one, when you want your life to change, just any change might not be worth it, right? Before pushing yourself to make a change or pursue something new, find out what you value, find out what might be interesting and satisfying to you, and also find out the demons in your head that are getting in the way of that. And then start to form your plan or your vision for making a change around something that actually excites you and draws you in, rather than making a change just to make a change. Because that may be a recipe for getting stuck and not being able to push yourself over the edge. Number two, that risk-taking is an essential ingredient to a meaningful and fulfilling life, not just professionally, but also personally. And I think maybe most of us are delusional optimists in the realm of romance and relationships, and understand that in order to connect deeply, in order to have intimacy, even a friendship on an intimate level, that we have to be willing to risk that everything may fall apart. That is the reality of engaging with the most deeply fulfilling things in this life. And so many of us do it rather well on the personal side, and I encourage us to be able to tap into that same willingness to take risks in order to find a professional life that is satisfying and that draws us in that same way. And then lastly, what I want you all to know is that optimism is an essential ingredient for being able to face those risks and to be able to weather the storm of what it means to take a risk. And that optimism is a tool and an antidote to becoming stuck that is available to all of us. And what it means to think optimistically is not necessarily to be happy or cheerful or positive. What it means to think optimistically is specifically to see the setbacks that we face as not going to be permanent, not pervading, not ruining our whole life, and not personal. So not blaming ourselves. So thank you for listening in today. This has been This Miraculous Life. I encourage you all to share your own letters and questions with me. And if you have a question or a letter, please send it to me at sarah@thismiraculouslife.com.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.